This morning we're starting the book of Numbers, and I tell you what, I'm excited about this. I love the book of Numbers, except the only problem I have with Numbers is it has a lot of numbers in it. It's like being at a business meeting when they're reading the financial statement and everybody's eyes just glare over because there's numbers. I'm going to try to help you with that. As you remember, we did Genesis, Exodus, and then we skipped the book of Leviticus. In between the book of Exodus and Numbers is that book of Leviticus. It basically tells us how to live in the light of the Ten Commandments and the restrictions that go along with that, plus restrictions about family and marriage and life and interacting with other people, just all of life in general. And I made the decision to skip going through the book of Leviticus in this go-around because I want to keep the story rolling of what's going on with the children of Israel. Now, if we had done the book of Leviticus, there are some things in the book of Leviticus that are story-related. There are parts of stories that are there of telling us some things that happened to some people while they were in the wilderness, but basically, it's a legal book. It's a legal law. It's one of the only two books in our Bible that we literally can open up, point our finger at a verse, and if you were Jewish living before Christ, you could apply that to you. It was like a law. You didn't have to really worry about the context or anything. It's a verse. It's a law. Or it may have been a few verses that made up the law, but you would know those laws. So I've decided to go on to the book of Numbers. In the book of Numbers, we're going to pick up here in Numbers chapter 1, verse 1. It's interesting. It says, "Then the Lord spoke to Moses." You see that? I put that in bold. And as we read through the text, through all the lessons, you're going to notice that every time we come to this phrase, "the Lord spoke to Moses," it's going to be in bold. That's because it occurs in our book of Numbers 46 times. And every time it shows up, the Lord is fixing to add something special to his instruction and into the life. He's going to jump into the life, I should say that, of the Israelites. But it's not always good. Sometimes he jumps in to bless them. And sometimes he jumps in to curse them, depending on what they're doing. But the 46 times we see it occur, it's kind of interesting because we see and we understand that the Lord interacts in their life to guide them on through their wilderness journey, just as the Lord interacts in our lives still today. Every one of us, the Lord is guiding and directing. If you'll just get in tune with him and see how he is clearing the pathway for you, or he is putting stumbling blocks in your way. Have you ever been in a position where you thought the Lord put a stumbling block in front of you? Did you accidentally claim that it was Satan putting the stumbling block in front of you? And then a couple of years later, you realize that wasn't Satan doing it. That was God because he was protecting you. Every time a stumbling block comes in my way, I don't ever think it's Satan. I think it's God doing it for a good reason, and I need a jee-haw with the reason. Jee-haw, is that a good word? Do y'all know what that means, jee-haw? I kind of know what it means, but I'm not quite sure I know what it means. I think it has to do with, do what? We're in total, jee-haw means in total agreement? No, I think it means that you would get the cow, the horse or whatever, to either G or haw to the right. Isn't that what, right or left? Isn't that what it is? Right or left? Get on the, keep him on the right. Keep him in fact, whenever I was just a young minister, I had this deacon that loved just to chide me up one side and down the other. Chide's not the actual word he would use, but he was doing it, okay? I can't repeat the word he was going to do. Because he wanted to keep me in between the two furrows in the road. He wanted to keep me on the right path. And you know what? I appreciate him for that. I do. Because I remember those things that he said. Took me a while. Had to make some more mistakes. And then realized he was right. The Lord put him there. I thought Satan put him there. I thought it was of the devil to begin with. But I realized the Lord put him there for my purposes. Well, then the Lord spoke to Moses in the wilderness of Sinai, in the tent of meeting, on the first of the second month, in the second year after they had come out of the land of Egypt, saying, "Take a census of all the congregation of the sons of Israel, by their families, by their fathers' households, according to the number of names, every male, head by head, from 20 years old and upward, who are able to go out to war in Israel. You and Aaron shall number them by their armies. Okay, first off, right off the bat, last week's lesson, we were doing a series of topical lessons, and I was talking to you about added text. So, does anybody see some added text in that passage? I just want to see if you remember. You see, it's in italics. It says, "Who is able to." Well, that's added text of the committee who is trying to tell us, help us understand. Actually, if we took it out, it's okay. From 20 years old and upward, whoever go out to war in Israel. Okay? So in other words, what we're talking about here in the book of Numbers to begin with, and it's called Numbers because there's lots of numbering in the book of Numbers. Numbers, numbers, numbers. That's kind of the name of the game for the book of Numbers. It's just what happens. So we have to grin and bear it. But what the Lord has told Moses to do is he said, I want you to go and I want you to number every male 20 years old and up who is able to go out to war. And here's the reason why. We don't know it yet, but we're fixing to know it. The Lord is fixing to raise that cloud and that fire column at night, the cloud by day, and it's going to begin to move down the road. And that means that it's time to take down this tabernacle that they have just put up. In fact, they've only had it up for 30 days. It's up. It's been consecrated. It's been sanctified. The priests have been consecrated. They're all in their positions. They're in their robes. They're doing their stuff. They are in full-blown worship of the Lord every day or every week as they are required to do. They are following the law exactly. The tabernacle was finished exactly 31 days before this passage picks up here in Numbers chapter 1. And the Lord says, okay, now we're going to send you out and we need to get some people in charge and we need to get the numbers of the men in each section of the army in place so that we know how many men we have. And so here we are. We are in on the first day of the second month of the second year out of Egypt. Follow me over here. I got a little timeline here. When we left the last chapter of the book of Exodus, we were on the first day of the first month of the second year. So that month to us would have been month one, day one, year 2713 ACA. When you see ACA, let me remind you, I use that to mean after the creation of Adam. ACA, after creation of Adam. Because I ran that numbering through Genesis and I ran it through Exodus, I'm also going to continue running it all the way through. Now, it just so happens that I have a book that's going to be published this year. It actually is three volumes. It's called The Book of Days, of which I have successfully harmonized 7,000 years of days in the Hebrew calendar with 7,000 years on the Julian calendar and on the Gregorian calendar, not only where we live now that we know of, but creating those dates going backwards so that if we had landed on that date back in that year, we would know exactly what day that would have been called today, either on the Gregorian calendar and the Julian calendar. And by the way, there is a point before 1852 that those dates would not match up. They would be several dates off. So there's actually two dates there, so you get to pick the one you want. I choose to pick the Gregorian calendar because that's the one that we're on now. That's where we are, so that's the one I choose to pick. But anyway, on Nisan the 1st of 2713, after the creation of Adam, that's where we left off in the book of Exodus. Everything is consecrated, and over the next 12 days, Exodus left us with the instruction that each tribe in a specific order was to bring a specific number of offerings to be offered to consecrate the tribe after all this tabernacle stuff was consecrated. And so the tribe would bring on. So Reuben would bring first, and they went in order of the birth line of Jacob's sons. So tribe by tribe. All right. Now we are in we are 1 month later, exactly 30 days later. We're in the second month, the first day of that very same year. And if you want to be technical, what would it have been if our Gregorian calendar that we have today rolled back? If it had rolled back, so we have to recreate it going back. If it had rolled back, it would have been Monday, Monday, April the 2nd of 1461 B.C. So when you hear those B.C. numbers, when was the Exodus? Well, 2 years into the Exodus, it's 1461. So it's April the 2nd. It happens to be a Monday. That's the day that we're talking about. It is the first day of Iyar. Now, what's interesting is when the children of Israel went into Egypt, they did not call the months by any name except for month 1, 2, 3, 4 through 12. And that is going to continue on even through the entire journey. So when we see this say to us in the first month on the first day, that's what they called it. Now, later on, by the time we get to King Solomon, somewhere, and King Solomon is the first place that we see it, somewhere before there, this second month had picked up the name of Ziv, Z-I-V. That word means light or to glow. So it picked up that name. And that's how it's used during the time of the kings. But whenever the Israelites get sent over into exile, when they come back, they're going to come back with new names for their months. They're going to come back with the name for that second month of I-Y-A-R. Sometimes you'll see it written with two Y's, I-Y-Y-A-R. Those are Babylonian names. In fact, the entire Jewish calendar of today that you hear all these names of Nisan and Ibid and all that kind of stuff, those names are all Babylonian names that they have. So the Jewish people are using Babylonian names on their holy Jewish calendar today. Now, doesn't that make sense? But it's just the way it is. It's how they did it. And actually, they're very thankful to Cyrus the Great, who sent them back, and also Nebuchadnezzar, who protected them through all of that. It was actually God's will. They found out that it was part of the prophecy for them to be there. They come back. They rebuild. Persian government helps them rebuild the temple and all of that. And they're all fine and dandy with having Babylonian names. And so we have this occurring here. We are 30 days left. It's April the 2nd on Monday, and they're there. And the Lord has said, hey, we need to take a census of all the people. So we pick up in the next verse, which is going to be verse 4. It says, with you, moreover, there shall be a man of each tribe, each one head of his own father's house. These then are the names of the men who shall stand with you. Just pause right there. I'm not going to suffer y'all to go through those names, but rather look down in the chart I have down below. As you get through the names, it's rather redundant 12 times over. In fact, they'll say, because just look at chart one, the number one in the chart. They're going to tell us the tribe, which is Reuben. They're going to tell us that they want us to go to the father's house of Shedeur and to pick the man as the leader of the tribe. His name is Elzur. And with Simeon's house, number two, we're going to go through pick the man who has the father's name, Sherishadadi or whatever that is. Okay, I did not pronounce that correctly. So let me explain what's going on here. In these tribes that are out there, the Lord has decided on one man per tribe to be the leader of that tribe in all the war efforts. Moses did not pick that name. Aaron did not pick that name or that man. The Lord picked that man. And whether that man was the head of the tribe already or whether he was not, after the Lord has placed these names in front of Moses and said, go select these 12 men. These 12 men are the default leaders of these tribes from now on until they die. Now, the reason why the Lord says, I want you to select, for instance, Elzur, whose father was Seldur, is because back in there, and we know this, we have heard of, for instance, Joseph Ben-Hur. And y'all see the movie Ben-Hur, okay? Ben-Hur, the word Ben means son of, and Hur is, of course, the name of the father. So Joseph Ben-Hur was Joseph, the son of Ben. Now, in this room, we've probably, you know, have 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 James, 10 Jims, 10 Mikes, 10 Chucks, you know, 10, we haven't got but one, sorry, there's nobody else in here with your name. Okay, good, all right. But you've got common names, and these names of these 12 men are common. Very common. They're Jewish names, so they're very common. Well, for instance, my father's name was Sterling. So if we went around to all those of you who have the nickname Jim or James, and all of y'all have a father's name, your father's name, I'm probably the only one that would be Jim, son of Sterling. You follow me? So you know exactly which Jim's the right Jim. Or Mike, son of David. Or Mark, son of Timothy, okay? You line the son up with the father, and you know exactly who you're talking about. You get to the New Testament, there's a lot of those names like that in the New Testament, so that we know who is the son of who. You know, James, the son of Alphaeus. Thaddeus, the son of Alphaeus. John, the son of Alphaeus. By the way, Judas, the son of Alphaeus. And you'll see that. There's four of them there. They're all the sons of Alphaeus, and they're all named that way. And so now we know that they are all sons of the same man. It's the way the Jewish people did it. So here we have these 12 leaders who are put in place. With that, we move on. Verse 16. These are they who were called of the congregation, the leaders of their father's tribes. They were the heads of the divisions of Israel. So if they weren't heads beforehand, they are now, in other words. Verse 17. So Moses and Aaron took these men who had been designated by name, and they assembled all the congregation together on the first of the second month, and they registered by ancestry in their families, by their father's households, according to the number of names, from 20 years old and upward, head by head, just as the Lord had commanded Moses. So he numbered them in the wilderness of Sinai. So there they are. They are still at the foot of the Mount of Sinai, where they got the Ten Commandments, where they had formed the golden calf, where the earthquake had opened to swallow up all those who did the golden calf, where just over the ridge from where they had drank water from the split rock, where they had done many things there, where they had eaten manna every day, where they had eaten quail until it was coming out of their nostrils, all the stuff that they have done there. They've been there about at least a year and a half. That's where they also took the offering and made all the tabernacle and the menorah and the Ark of the Covenant and the all the sockets and the boards and everything and the coverings and the curtains for everything. They've made it all right there. That's where they are, where they're stationed. And now they're gathered again, and Moses has said, okay, these are the 12 leaders. Now, you 12 leaders, I want you to go out to your tribes, and I want you to number all the men 20 years and older. So we pick up with verse 20. And because this is so redundant, I'm going to read the first one only, okay? Now, the sons of Reuben, Israel's firstborn, their genealogy registration by their family, by their father's household, according to the number of names, head by head, every male from 20 years old and upward, whoever go out to war, the numbered men of the tribe of Reuben were 46,500. In 430 years in Egypt, Reuben has gone from Reuben, and I believe two sons when they actually moved there, to now 46,500 men, 20 years old and up. Okay, now time out before we think of any. Let's go through the rest of the list, but just look at the last number in each of the list. Simon, 59,300. Gad, 45,650. Judah, 74,600. Wasn't he blessed? Issachar, 54,400. Zebulun, 57,400. Ephraim, 40,500. Manasseh, 32,200. By the way, that's Joseph. So if you add those two together of Joseph, it was actually 73,700. Okay, got it. Okay, Benjamin, 35,400. Dan, 62,700. Asher, 41,500. Do I sound like a financial statement yet? Yep. Naphtali, 53,400. But in verse 44, it picks up and says, these are the ones who were numbered, who Moses and Aaron numbered with the leaders of Israel, 12 men, each of whom was of his own father's household. So all of the numbered men of the sons of Israel by their father's household from 20 years old and upward, whoever go out to war in Israel, even all the numbered men were 603,550 men. Now, I want you to understand. You see that chart there. I've got them all together. It's very interesting. Do you notice in that chart that you do not see Levi? Do you also notice that you do not see Joseph? And yet, you see Joseph's two boys who headed two tribes who, in fact, whenever Joseph pulled them, if you remember the story, up to his father Jacob, as Jacob was dying, Manasseh was on the right hand and Ephraim was on the left hand because Ephraim was the youngest. Manasseh was the oldest. And Joseph expect Jacob, his father, to bless the oldest and then give a blessing to the younger, but to pass on the blessing of Joseph to the oldest. And do you remember what Jacob did? Blind Jacob crossed his arms and put the major blessing on Ephraim and the minor blessing on Manasseh. Joseph objected, but Jacob corrected him and gave a double blessing to Joseph. So the Levites are not included in the count, but in Joseph he gets a double blessing in that both of his sons are the heads of tribes. That takes the place of Joseph by himself and the place of Levi. So Ephraim and Manasseh are in the lot. Verse 47. The Levites, however, were not numbered among them by their father's tribes. That doesn't mean that we're not going to number them, by the way. It just means that in this census, we're not numbering them. We are going to number them soon, but not today and not in this passage. For the Lord had spoken to Moses, saying, only the tribe of Levi you shall not number, nor shall you take their census among the sons of Israel. That's important. Among the sons of Israel means you're not going to ever count them as part of the sons of Israel. They're going to have a special place, by the way. Verse 50. But you shall appoint the Levites over the tabernacle of the testimony and over all its furnishings and over all its that belongs to it. They shall carry the tabernacle and all its furnishings, and they shall take care of it. They shall also camp around the tabernacle. So when the tabernacle is to set out, the Levites shall take it down. And when the tabernacle is to encamp, the Levites shall set it up. But the laymen, that would be all the other 12 tribes. You got that? All the other. But the laymen who come near shall be put to death. So if anyone of the tribe of Judah or anybody of the tribe of Reuben or Benjamin or Issachar or Asher or Zebulun or Dan or Gad or Naphtali, if any of them were to come near to the tabernacle past the where the Levites are camping, the penalty for them being that close is death. So anytime in the study of Numbers when I say the penalty is, you know what the penalty is. It's death. and it comes swift and it comes quick from the Lord. All right, going on. Verse 52. The sons of Israel shall camp, each man by his own camp, and each man by his own standard according to their armies. But the Levites shall camp around the tabernacle of the testimony so that there will be no wrath on the congregation. The wrath of God on the congregation. That's the 12 tribes of the sons of Israel. So the Levites shall keep charge of the tabernacle and of the testimony. So we look right up here. I've drawn you a map, a picture. Why? Because I do better with pictures than I do with words. So even when I do words, I like to sketch out pictures because I'm a visual person, and most of the men in here also are that way. You like pictures. So I've got a campsite drawn, but I want to focus right in the middle first. The tabernacle is going to be in the middle of the camp, and the Levites are going to camp all the way around it. Now, as of right now, we don't know the count of the Levites, and we don't know which group of Levites under which family name, be the Gershites or the Korites, or which family name is going to camp where. We're going to find that out. So we'll correct this in another lesson. But right now we're just going to say the Levites, all those descendants of the tribe of Levi, are going to be around the tabernacle to guard the people from coming near to the tabernacle, because the penalty of one of these people camping here, coming past the Levites to here, is death. All right. So that's where we are just to begin with. The tribes are going to camp around it, just like you see on the board, but I will pick that up in just a minute, because I have separated one verse that I think is very interesting as we go through the text. It's verse 54. Thus the sons of Israel did according to all which the Lord had commanded Moses, so they did. You know what? I had to stop and I had to wonder. And I had to say to myself, it's about time. It's about time. Even in the last 2 years, there's been these pockets and groups of people saying, you brought us out here to Mount Sinai. We could have been eating our porridge over there in Egypt. We could have been over there where we knew what it was like. You know, they were still longing, even though they've got food and they've got water and they've got quail, meat. They've got whatever they need being provided for them. We still could have been back in Egypt. And that's that complaint still going on. So this same group of people that complained at Moses at its first stop in Succoth coming out, and then complained when they got to that big old huge beach that is down at the Red Sea, that they had to go through that little cavern area, the valleys between these two huge mountains, which wasn't very wide. And they come down and they get to that beach right there on the Red Sea, and they can't go that way without going to the sea, and they can't go this way without going to the sea, and this way is Red Sea for about 15 miles across, and this way back here is the cavern they just came through, not the cavern but the gully, I guess you'd call it, that they came from. And lo and behold, they hear the hoof prints and see the dust of Pharaoh and his men coming, closing in on them, and they're on this beach that, if you'll go look it up, is about 25 square miles large. 25 square miles large. And I'm sure that even though we have 603,550 men 20 years old and up, not counting the women, no wives are counted, no daughters are counted, no one under the age of 19, under the age of 20 men, 19 and under, are not counted. And more than likely, our translators who added the text who were able were correct that there are feeble people who were also up on a cart that couldn't wield a sword at all. So they're not counted. So when you add all that up, how many people do we have out there? Well, if you just go with the 603,000 guys, that's a lot. And the area there, I have every confidence, but that by the time they set up their tents, their lean-tos, and by the time they had all their cattle, their sheep, their oxen, all the birds and all the chickens and everything they brought out of Egypt, plus all the kiddos, plus all the family, everything, they covered 25 square miles of beach. And lo and behold, when the sound of the hooves of King Pharaoh and the dust is coming, they start complaining about Moses. What in the world have you done to us? You have brought us here to kill us. We have nowhere to turn. And Moses turns around and goes over to the water. And you know what happens? And they walk across. Those same people get on the other side and they're complaining about food and water. They walk down the beach, walk down the edge. They finally come to a spring. It's salt water. It's bitter water. They said, Moses, you brought us out here for bitter water. What are we going to do? We can't drink this salt water coming up out of this fountain because it's going to kill us. We can't do this. It'll dehydrate us. The Lord says to Moses, throw a certain branch into the fountain. He does, and it becomes fresh water. And then they go down. They're hungry. They want some dates, something sweet to eat. He takes them to the 70 springs and the 70 date palms that they find, and they get something sweet to eat to go along with their quail that they're fixing to get because they've complained about just eating this little white stuff that shows up on the ground. Well, you know, it looks like little seeds. They have to pick it up every day, and it putrefies if they get too much by morning. They're just complaining, 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 complaining. Have you ever known a complainer in this world? Do you know once you know a complainer, they never stop complaining? I don't think once they pick up the ability to complain and see that it gets the response that they want, they complain until the day they die. It's too hot. It's not cold enough. There is no meal in this world that is exactly right. It is either too hot for somebody or too cold for somebody else, and you're eating off the same plate with a fork and spoon. I'm glad my daughter's like me. Our favorite foods are cold, right out of the refrigerator. Taco Bell tacos. You buy a dozen, stick them in the refrigerator, and pull them right out and eat them. Yum, yum. They are better than Pop-Tarts any day. By the way, Pop-Tarts are better when they're not put in a toaster for my daughter and myself. We both like them just like they come out of the foil little wrapper. Except for there's one problem with them Pop-Tarts is that when they started making them when I was just a kid many decades ago, they were three times as thick as they are now. Now they're just a little wafer. I mean, they haven't got enough skim of sweetness in them to even bother. I mean, you have to pile four of them together to get what you used to get. And by the way, that's a favorite task of mine, to pile four of them together. I often thought I might as well get some duct tape and just wrap them together so they act as one. Gripers and complainers. Well, they've complained about everything. They complained about not having a God to worship, so they make a golden calf. They've complained about that. They've complained they've drunk water from. They complained they didn't have any water, so Moses had to go over and strike a rock, and out comes the water. You know, so the Israelites can say, "Yeah, we had water on the rocks," because they really did, right out of the rock. It's about time they decide to follow the commandments of the Lord, wouldn't you say? 2 years in having absolute incredible miracles happen in front of them, and they still forget. I think some of them must have had Alzheimer's, and they didn't even know what Alzheimer's was back then. But God did, by the way. He may actually have given some of them Alzheimer's. I don't know. We're through with chapter 1, and we won't go back. We're now on chapter 2. Now, the Lord spoke to Moses. You see, it's in bold letters for you, because here it pops up again. Second time it's popped up. It means something new is going to happen here. And he said to Moses and Aaron, saying, "The sons of Israel shall camp, each by his own standard, with his banner, the banners of his father's household. They shall camp around the tent of meeting at a distance." I cannot pass this up. This is exciting to me. I know it's probably boring to you, but it's exciting to me. Yes, what's your question? Well, that's my answer I'm fixing to give you. That's the reason it's exciting to me. This is something we shouldn't pass up. Here's what a standard is. A standard is a large flag. See my board here? Let's just start here, right here. It is the large flag. And what we're going to see as we read through chapter 2, that the sides, the placement of the each camp, each tribe was to be on a side, north, south, east, west, of the tabernacle. And so we're on the east side of the tabernacle, and there is going to be a standard, which we're fixing to read about in just a minute, called the Standard of Judah. It is the big flag. Now, Zebulun and Issachar are going to be on the same side as Judah always. It is their position from now on, even after they get into Jerusalem and all of that with King David, where's their placing and all that? Or, well, I'll just back it up. At least until they get into David's reign, really with King Saul, where they are placed and everything, these standards and these banners are still very important. But while they're in the wilderness, they're going to be in this order always. And so the standard is a huge flag. Would be hung up, a standard, a banner, and that meant Judah and Issachar and Zebulun would be watching for Judah's standard. Reuben has a standard also. Reuben's standard would be this big flag for Simeon and Gad. So wherever Reuben is, the tribe of Reuben is, Simeon tribe and Gad tribe will be looking for Reuben's standard, big flag. That's how they know if they get separated where they're supposed to go camp. On the west side, Ephraim is going to have a standard. And on the north side, Dan's going to have the standard. Now, what are the banners? There's a disagreement on what the banners are because of translation. We've translated into the English word banners, but what did it really mean? Well, it could have been a small flag, or it could have been a carving up on a pole. We don't know which, so in the notes I've just told you it's either one of those, but we don't know exactly. Or it could have been a combination of the two. So if you'll see in each one of these little tribal areas, I've put a different color, a bunch of little banners in here. The banners would be used to say, hey, we are Asher and we're over here and we're setting our boundary lines. So come inside these banners and this is where you're supposed to camp, or you camp among them. So not as high as the standard, the big flag flying, you've got these little flags. And so just think about it. You know, all the Pruitt family has a little green triangle flag and y'all are waving it over here, and the Hastings has a little red flag and we're right waving it over here. And by the way, between the two of us, there's not enough to even spit on, you know, as tribes. All right, but then we've got the Smith family. Well, have you ever opened up a phone book and looked at the Smiths? Well, they might as well all vote together because they're going to get their way, you know. And so you see a whole bunch of black little banners that say Smith on them. I had to pick black. I just was picking on you for some reason. I'm sorry. It's a Smith thing, you know. Just, oh, if there's any other Smiths in the room, I'm really talking about Ernest. Okay. You go by another name, okay? Anyway, so here we have these tribes. Ernest, I'm glad you're back from Arkansas. Yes. Anyway, so we got different banners. That's what standards and banners are. They are going to be the signal whenever they're out in battle or whatever. They know where to go because of the banners, because they're going to fight with their tribes. And when they come back home, they're going to know where to go because of the standard, because Judah has set up the standard. And even though Judah's got little banners for its people to do its boundaries, they have the big standard of banner to make sure that Issachar and Zebulun know to come join them there at the campground. Okay, so here we go. On the east side, it says this. Now, those who camp on the east side towards the sunrise, you got that? Towards the sunrise? Of the standard of the camp of Judah, by their names, by their armies, and the leaders of the sons of Judah. And then you pick up this name of this leader, and then the name of that leader, that son, is going to have, they're going to number them out. And so Judah's going to have 74,600. Issachar's going to have 54,400. Zebulun's going to have 57,400. And so the total number that's going to be on the east side of the camp is 186,400. You follow me there? Okay, so here we go. So on the east side, that is interesting because here we've got another thing that's going on here. There is no word in the Hebrew language for east, south, north, or west. No word. When they said on the east side, it was always forward or front. West was always back or backward. South was always to the right from that position, and north was always to the left. When it said, go out this way and head this way forward 15 steps and then turn left, how did they know which way to go? They knew because they went forward, and forward was always facing the sun. One of the things that you may or may not have caught in most of the movies that deal with Christian-Muslim interactions, like during the Crusades and things like that, when it came time for prayer of a Muslim, they had to determine where the east was, because they had to face forward to lay their pallet down to have their five prayers per day. So Jewish people did the same thing. Remember Daniel in the times of prayers? They did three times per day. Jews did three times per day. Muslims did five, because Muslims kind of copied the Jewish folks. But they still had to face east. We're going to find out as we go through this that the tabernacle always must face, the door of the tabernacle always must face to the east or to the sunrise, never to the sunset. And so Judah is always going to be on the east side of the tabernacle, which is facing east also. That's where their place is. Judah, because it's the prime tribe, is going to be in between the other two tribes. I do not know, and we do not know, whether Issachar or Zebulun were in this position or flipped. They were either here or the other way around. We don't know which, but we do know that they camped on either side of Judah. You follow me? So I just arbitrarily put this here, and I'm being honest with you. We don't know if Issachar belonged here and Zebulun up here or the other way around. It really doesn't matter. They're on the front line, and there's 186,400 men able to fight, able to carry a sword, who are guarding the front of the tabernacle. Do you see it? Okay, look here next. Go to Reuben in the south. Just skip the whole thing and go to the chart. By the way, the chart is wrong. It says total of three tribes on the east. That should say south. That was a copy and a mistake. I've got to correct the notes, because on the south, we have the tribe of Reuben, Simeon, Gad, and they equal 150. Did I write that right? No, I did not. We have 151, see if I can do this with an eraser, 1,450. Got it right. Okay, good. So we've got 151,000 men who are able to fight, who are on the right flank of the tabernacle all the time. So the biggest group is on the front. The right flank has not quite as many, but pretty good group. Then you look next and look at the, and then what happens next is in chapter 2, verse 17, where I say the Levites. Then the tent of meeting shall be set out, the camp of the Levites in the midst of the camps, just as they camp. So they shall set out every man in his place by their standards. Okay, so here's what we've got. For some reason in the Lord's will, he tells us about the front. He tells us about the right flank. And then he tells us about where the Levites are going to camp in between the camps, in between the tribes, in the center, with the tabernacle in between. Now, what he's saying to us is whenever they leave and when they go out, here's what's going to happen. As they go out to journey, Judah is going to take the lead, followed by either Issachar or Zebulun. And believe me, it's set. We just don't know which it's set. They will always go in the same direction, in the same form, in the same order. Then Reuben will follow after whichever tribe comes last of these three, followed by either Simeon or Gad. Then the Levites will follow carrying the tabernacle. Six tribes in front of the tabernacle, and that will leave six tribes in the back, of which Dan is next. So it'll be front, right, left, and Ephraim, Manasseh, and Benjamin always take up the rear. You follow me? Okay, good. So that actually gets us down through the next little bit of what is said through all this passage. Verse 32 says this. These are the numbers of the men of the sons of Israel by their fathers' households. The total of the number of men of the camp was 603,550. The Levites, however, were not numbered among the sons of Israel, just as the Lord had commanded Moses. Although it's not going to be long, we're going to know how many Levites are there. They're just not numbered according to these folks. Verse 34. Thus the sons of Israel did, according to all the Lord commanded Moses. So they camped by their standards, and so they set out, everyone by his families, according to his father's household. And quite interesting with that, I wish the Lord had gone ahead and said, by his father's household, according to their banners, because their banners were involved too. Those banners were always flying. That banner, remember, is the smaller flags that identify what tribe is holding together there. So in obedience, they go out. Chapter 3, verse 1. Can you believe it? We're already in chapter 3. Well, we're going to slow down here just a little bit. Okay. Now these are the records of the generations of Aaron and Moses at the time when the Lord spoke with Moses on Mount Sinai. Verse 2. These then are the names of the sons of Aaron. Nadab, the firstborn. So Nadab's the baby. No, Nadab's the oldest. Let me put it that way. The first baby of Aaron. And Abihu, Eleazar, and Ithamar. These are the names of the sons of Aaron, the anointed priest, whom he ordained to serve as priest. When did he ordain them? 30 days before all the what we just went through and all the instruction we just went through. That all happened on the first day of the second month. And 30 days before, on the first day of the first month, they were ordained. They got to put on their tunics. They got to put on their robes. They got to put on their caps. They were barefooted. They put their the different things that they've got to do. They were anointed with oil. They were set aside. They are ready to serve in the temple on the first day, and they start serving. And they're going to serve every day in the temple until something dramatic happens. Verse 4. But Nadab and Abihu died before the Lord when they offered strange fire before the Lord in the wilderness of Sinai. And they had no children. We don't know if they were married or not, but we do know they didn't have any children. So Eleazar and Ithamar served as priests in the lifetime of their father Aaron. Time out. The last sentence tells us something. It tells us that the book of Numbers was not completely finished or edited until after Aaron dies. And really after Moses dies, because here is a record that Eleazar and Ithamar served for the entire lifetime of Aaron, their father. So how do they know how long the lifetime is? We don't know. It had to be that Aaron died and this addition was put in here, properly put in here for us by the Lord, breathed of God. But we look back here and we say, okay, when did Nadab and Abihu die? Because back in Exodus chapter 40, they're consecrated on that first day. And we're only 30 days down the road. So when did they die? And why did they die? And what was strange fire offered before the Lord? What does that mean? Well, to get that record, we have to go back to Leviticus chapter 10, but really we have to start in chapter 9 where the story begins. So let's read that story. Now, it came about on the eighth day that Moses called Aaron and his sons and the elders of Israel. The eighth day when? The eighth day after the consecration of the tabernacles. So we are on the Nisan the 8th of 2713 after the creation of Adam. We are 8 days from the setting up of the tabernacle and the consecration. But we are still within the month before the story starts in Numbers. It says, take for yourself a calf, a bull for the sin offering, and of a ram for the burnt offering, both without defect, and offer them before the Lord. Verse 22, then Aaron lifted up his hands towards the people and blessed them, and he stepped down after making the sin offering and the burnt offering and the peace offering. And Moses and Aaron went into the tent of meeting. When they came out and and blessed the people, the glory of the Lord appeared to all the people. Now remember, they've got this stuff up on this fire pit ready for it to start happening on the burnt altar. Then fire came out from before the Lord, out from the place of the Ark of the Covenant. Can't you just imagine that fire rolling out through the front of that tabernacle temple and not catching anything afire and doing this? And the burnt consumed the burnt offering and the portion of the fat on the altar. And when all the people saw it, they shouted and fell on their faces. I think I'd have got on my face faster than I shouted, if you really want to know if I saw that happen. But they had seen so many things, they're probably getting common used to it. You know that? Miracles of God. Oh, yeah, God's real. Then verse 1 of chapter 10. Now Nadab and Abihu, the sons of Aaron, took their respective fire pans. What's a fire pan? Remember I told you about this. Think about a pan, a small pan that you cook eggs in. It's got a handle on it. Got a handle, got a pan out here. And it's got a lid that goes on it. Probably was not hinged because they really couldn't do hinges back then. But it's a lid that had holes in it. So what they would do is they'd take that saucepan, they'd fill it with coals out of the fire that's burning over there at the burnt altar, which, by the way, the fire was started by the Lord. It's His fire. He lit it. And they take some of those coals and they put the incense on top of those coals, put the lid on it that had the little holes in it, and the incense smoke would come out of that censer. It's a fire pan, but we called it a censer. We think of censers as those little giddy-ups that you little hang on chains and you go, you know, that's not the way it was. It was actually pans that they used. So looking on, verse 1. Let's read that again. Now Nadab and Abihu, the sons of Aaron, took their respective fire pans, and after putting fire in them, placed incense on it and offered strange fire before the Lord, which he had not commanded them. Verse 2, and fire came out from the presence of the Lord and consumed them, and they died before the Lord. The same fire that lit the altar of incense, the brazen altar to consume the fat and the meat and all of that, that came out of the presence of the Lord in the Ark of the Covenant behind the Holy of Holies through the front door of the tabernacle, just came out again and consumed and killed Nadab and Abihu. Verse 3. Then Moses said to Aaron, it is what the Lord spoke, saying, by those who come near me, I will be treated as holy, and before all the people, I will be honored. So Aaron therefore kept silent. Moses called also Mishael and Elzaphan, the sons of Aaron's uncle Uziel, and said to them, come forward and carry your two relatives out from in front of the sanctuary to the side outside of the camp. So they came forward and carried them still in their tunics, their priestly tunics, to the outside of the camp, as Moses had said. Then Moses said to Aaron and to his sons Eleazar and Ithamar, do not uncover your heads. Don't take off your tunics. Don't tear your clothes. Well, they're wearing the priestly clothes, so that you will not die and that he will not become wrathful against the congregation. You guys are priests. You guys are ministers. You're doing your duty. Don't you mourn right now. If you do, his wrath will go out on the entire congregation. But your kinsmen and the whole house of Israel shall bewail the burning which the Lord has brought about. In other words, all your relatives can cry and mourn, but Aaron, Ithamar, and Eleazar, you are not to mourn. You shall not even go out from the doorway of the tent of meeting, or you will die. For the Lord's anointing oil is upon you. So they did according to the words of Moses. So here we are. Moses' son had been consecrated on that Nisan, the first of 2713 ACA. On the Sabbath day, by the way. 8 days later, on Sunday, Nisan the 8th, 2713, Nadab and Abihu offer the strange fire in the tabernacle. How did this happen? That which is holy, I want to always remind you, comes from the Lord. And that which is strange always comes from man. That word strange actually means common. In other words, if we were translating this today, we would not use the word strange because it doesn't fit our dictionary of words that we use. Now, we were in 1525 A.D., and we were Tyndale trying to translate this, which Tyndale did. The word strange was a correct word. But today, we would use the word common. The fire that Nabu and Abihu offered was what we'd call common fire. Here's the background. On the day of consecration, the offerings were all prepared. They were all put in place on the altar. And when the time came to be right, then for the lighting of the fire, the Lord performed that task. He lit the fire. The fire came out from before the Lord and consumed the burnt offerings and all the portions of fat on the altar. And when all the people saw it, they shouted and fell to their faces. Remember that? The Lord lit the fire. It was sacred fire. It was the Lord's fire. The Lord had struck that fire. It was then the responsibility of the people, the priest, to keep that fire lit, perpetually lit. The fire of the Lord was sacred, consecrated. It was holy. From that fire, the priest would then take their fire pans or their censers, and they'd add those coals from that fire of the Lord to the, and they would take and sprinkle them with that properly made incense, of which the exact recipe for that incense we know, and that incense could never be made for any other purpose with that recipe except for use in worship of the Lord. If you took that same mixture, that same proportions, and used it in your home for worship or for just use, the penalty was always, always. Penalty was death. We got that in the book of Exodus. And so, we have to assume here, because the Lord was not upset with the incense, he was upset with the fire. So, Nadab and Abihu are using the right incense, but the wrong source of fire. The problem with that is Nadab and Abihu knew the importance of the Lord's fire. They had received this in specific instructions about that fire 7 days before. Yet, for some reason, and it's deemed sinful by the Lord, by the way, Nadab and Abihu filled their fire pans with coals of fire from some source other than the brazen altar or a fire pot that had been filled with coals from the brazen altar or from a candle that had or a source that would be to feed the candles or whatever from a source besides what the Lord had struck. The menorah was lit with the proper fire from the brazen altar that the Lord started. Everything in the area of the tabernacle, all the fire that was used, was to be from the fire that the Lord started. It was sacred fire. It was his fire. And because the scripture only blames the fire, we have to understand that in this case, the deaths had to be because simply of the source of the fire that Nadab and Abihu used to fill their fire pans. In the Leviticus 10 passage, we find Aaron with all four sons in the tabernacle on the 8th day after the formal consecration. They've been doing this for 7 days. By the way, the consecration of each tribe is not over. Four more tribes, actually five, counting the day of the eighth day, five tribes have to bring their huge offerings for the priest to handle them that day also, so the tribes can be consecrated. The tribes were not going to be finished being consecrated until the 12th day of Nisan, and this is the eighth day of Nisan, right in the middle of the consecration of the tribes. The sons are all assisting Aaron in his daily routine of worship before the Lord, and Aaron has prepared his fire pan appropriately in accordance with the Lord, and so has Ithamar and Eleazar. They've done that. But Nadab and Abihu, for some reason, have not. And when these two approach the tabernacle to perform their duties, armed with their fire pans, prepared incorrectly, the same fire of the Lord that had kindled the brazen altar came out of the temple and flared and killed those two sons. They were burnt to a crisp, I promise you. Aaron and the remaining two sons were instructed by Moses. This is my words. Aaron, Eleazar, Ithamar, do not flinch. Don't move. The two dead boys were on the ground, and Aaron and the two living boys were required as ministers of the Lord to continue their duties. They were not allowed to grieve. They were not allowed to shed a tear. They were not allowed to take a break. They were not allowed to bury their own kin, their son and brothers. Moses called for Mishael and Elzaphan, the cousins of the dead brothers, the cousins of the dead brothers, to enter the complex and carry the corpses outside of the camp and to bury them. Did you notice that when Moses removed the bodies, they were still in their priestly garments? The priestly garments were burnt too, and they were buried wearing those priestly garments. Even the garments that were carefully made just a month or so before for the purpose of perpetual worship of the Lord, whoever was the priest, are now burnt, and they're being buried in the ground outside the camp on these two dead boys. Did you also notice that the extended families of Nabu and Abihu were allowed to mourn their deaths in their usual way, but their father and their priestly brothers were not? They had their jobs to do. They had to be in the service of the Lord. They had to do their work. The tabernacle duties overrode any personal feelings of the heart and of the soul of the father and the two brothers. Fortunately, the two brothers were childless, but the scripture does not indicate if they were married or not. We don't know that. The punishment here seems very terribly swift, if you ask me. And under the standards of Christianity that we hold, we kind of misread this passage. Here's what we do. We misunderstand the structure of the Lord's system for the Israelites. In the beginning, under what we call the Mosaic Law, and we call it that because it's this law that's being given through Moses from the Lord, form is paramount. How things were done meant more than why things were done. But in our thinking, yours and mine, the why supersedes the how. Oh, he had the right heart about it, even though it was the wrong thing. That's the way Westerners think. How's your heart? What's your intent? That's more important than why you did something the way you did it. Why? It's more important. I did it because I felt like it. I did it because I thought it was the best thing. I may not have done it the right way, but I did it, we hear. So in our Western mind, the intent carries the power. The mode of the methodology is often dismissed, even today, even in our worship. Did it get done with the right heart, we ask, or did it get done the wrong way out of compulsion? We tend to separate that which is the commandment of the Lord from that which is the moral and righteous obligation. With the Mosaic Law, the two are the same, by the way. The Lord requires the priests to be exact in their duties, according to his command, whether in form or intent. It did not matter to the Lord. We might think Nadab and Abihu were just trying to ignite the incense in their fire pans. Their intent was correct. They wanted to fulfill their duties with their fathers and their brothers. What was wrong with the source of the fire? Isn't fire fire? The answer's stark. It was the wrong fire because it was kindled by man. It was not kindled by God. Now I'm going to start meddling just a little bit in all of our lives. So listen closely. And I'm going to stick close to the commentary I've written so they don't miss anything. How often do we gather to worship in a manner kindled by man rather than God? How often have we brought that which is common rather than that which is sacred to God? How often does our Christian worship glow with a fire of self-will rather than His will? How often do we rush into worship with our burning desire instead of His burning desire? What kind of fire do we use? What kind of incense do we light? What kind of prayers do we present? What kind of form, what is the form of our worship? What does the Lord think about what we do in worship? Surely, we think that this punishment was severe. The priest had been doing their business for only 8 days. How could they have known the severity and the penalty? Why did the Lord not warn them first? Why did the Lord not give them a second chance? Isn't God the God of second chances? Why did the Lord not give them that chance? Preachers, for centuries now, or at least the decades of my life, have built whole sermons and regularly presented them on how God is the God of second chances. Why was the punishment so lightning fast and so early in the formation of this whole process? Why didn't the Lord wait to see if they did strange fire later, in other words, instead of here on the eighth day? Why was Nadab and Abihu without excuse and the punishment so extremely swift? It was because they were only 8 days from hearing the instruction. They were without excuse. It was because they had practiced for 7 days before and they knew how to do it right. They knew the penalty. They tested the system. They lost. Is God a God of second chances? That all depends. In most things, the answer is no. He is immovable. The penalty is set. Sin is sin, and refusal to place one's personal trust in Him will return the punishment of everlasting fire. With that, there are no second chances. In the form of the Mosaic Law, second chances rarely exist. Although they do, they rarely exist. The camp was to be ordered in a strict fashion. The tribes could not move that order around. The tribes had to be in a predetermined place. Its door could not face the north, the south, or the west. It had to face east. The whole complex had to be moved under a prescribed scheme. The Ark of the Covenant had to be carried in a certain way. And the scripture indicates that the swift and severe punishment of the Lord was dealt out regardless of intent. I want to remind you of Uzzah. In 2 Samuel chapter 6, 1 through 11, why did the Lord kill Uzzah? About 460 years after the death of Nadab and Abihu, after this day, about 460 years, King David was bringing the Ark of the Covenant up to Jerusalem. He had placed it on a newly made cart and that was being pulled by an ox. Poor man Uzzah, with all the best intentions in the world, he reached out to steady the ark, to keep it from falling when the ox stumbled. He was struck dead. Why? Because he was not authorized by the Lord to touch the ark. He broke the form of the Mosaic Law. He had the priest the ark on the poles that it was supposed to be carried with, and had that ark and the poles up on their shoulders and lifted it, and they were carrying it according to the prescribed instruction of the Lord, Uzzah would have had no reason to try to help the Lord protect the ark. Yes, Uzzah died because of the sin of David and the priest. Sinners bring heartaches on those who surround them. The punishment may be severe. Was Uzzah sinless? No. He was an Israelite, but he was not a Levite. He also knew the law and the penalty. His actions may have been in haste, but his death startled the nation, especially King David. It was a case of trying to do the right thing the wrong way. Not only was Uzzah wrong, but so was David. The tabernacle was still standing over in Gibeon. It was the official home of the Ark of the Covenant. David wanted to move the Ark to Jerusalem to put into the temple that he was going to build. He was already making the plans. And yet the Lord did not let David build the temple. The temple would not be built until after he died by Solomon, according to David's plans. David had snatched the ark from the tabernacle, put it on the new cart, and attempted to move it to his city where it did not belong. It belonged in the tabernacle. The cart incident shook David to his core. A man had died because of his sin. He had to regroup. He had to correct his action. He had to move it correctly. And he did. The Lord gave David a second chance, but he didn't give Uzzah a second chance. David was thankful to the Lord for the second chance. In fact, he wrote a song about it, about the event, and the following contains the portion that addresses the move of the ark and the Lord's acceptance of the city of Jerusalem as the place of the new home for the ark. And just two verses out of that psalm that's dedicated to this says, "For the Lord has chosen Zion. He's desired it for his habitation. This is my resting place forever. Here I will dwell, for I have desired it." Well, although David had a second chance, Uzzah did not. Although Aaron, Eleazar, and Ithamar had a second chance, Nadab and Abihu did not. Furthermore, the fiery death of Nadab and Abihu did not occur in secret. The whole camp was watching because it happened outside the tabernacle, between the tabernacle and the brazen altar. It witnessed the fury of the Lord once again firsthand. But my last word on that in this lesson is this. We cannot forget that the same nation of Israel that watched the fiery burning death of Nadab and Abihu had also witnessed the gracious gifts of the Lord many times in the past 2 years. And with that, we will pick up next week in verse 4 of chapter 3. Lord Jesus, we thank you for your word, your instruction. May we always come before you with the correct fire, with the correct incense, with the correct prayer, everything according to you and your will, not our will, Lord. That's what we ask for. In your name, amen and amen.